In this edition of the Federalist Society SCOTUS cast, Vanderbilt Law School professor Richard Nogarita comments on the recent Bell Atlantic Corporation versus Twombly case, which has implications for antitrust law and, as Professor Nogarita suggests in his commentary, beyond. And now, Professor Nogarita.
This is Professor Richard Nogarita at Vanderbilt University Law School. I'm going to be making some comments on a decision that the U.S. Supreme Court just issued in late May of 2007 in a case called Bell Atlantic versus Twombly. The Twombly case is a major decision. It deals with what it takes to dismiss a civil lawsuit simply on the pleadings prior to the discovery stage of litigation. This is a seemingly technical question of civil procedure, but Twombly illustrates that this technical question can have some major ramifications. Well, first of all, how did the Twombly case arise? The Twombly case was a proposed class action under the antitrust laws against the major firms in the telecommunications industry. The proposed plaintiff class in Twombly consisted of basically local telephone customers and people who subscribe to things like high-speed internet services from those local phone companies. And the basic allegation that the plaintiffs made was that the major firms in the telecommunications industry had agreed that they had conspired, it was alleged, to inhibit the growth of local phone companies, to inhibit their role as potential competitors to the incumbent firms that were already in the industry. Now, the tricky thing under the antitrust laws is to distinguish an illegal conspiracy to inhibit competition from just plain old, perfectly legal efforts by an incumbent company on its own, entirely without any conspiracy, to resist competition. Under the federal antitrust laws, it's not enough for the major companies in a given industry to try to inhibit their competitors. Free markets, after all, routinely involve efforts by the major firms to resist the efforts of other firms to break into their line of business in a substantial way. What's illegal under antitrust law is if the incumbent companies agree to suppress competition. It's illegal if there's a conspiracy to restrain trade, to use the words of the federal antitrust laws. Well, back in 1986, the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with this sort of allegation at a much later stage in the litigation process than we're dealing with it in Twombly. In 1986, the Supreme Court decided a case called Matsushita Electric versus Zenith. And the basic point the court made in Matsushita is that, well, after there's been extensive discovery in this sort of antitrust conspiracy type of case, if after there's extensive discovery, the evidence assembled by the plaintiffs really doesn't rule out the possibility that the defendants simply acted independently, then the plaintiff's lawsuit has to be dismissed at that point. Matsushita said at that point, summary judgment has to be granted in favor of the defendant. The case cannot proceed to trial. The Twombly case takes this process back one step further in the litigation process. Twombly asks, when can such a case be dismissed simply on the pleading, simply on the papers, before any discovery occurs at all in the litigation? There's a rule in the federal civil procedure rules that discusses this very point. Rule 8 of the civil procedure rules calls simply for, quote, a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. The idea of Rule 8 is simply to put the defendant on notice of the basic grounds for the lawsuit. The idea is not for the plaintiff to have to prove her case on simply on the written pleadings. The idea is just put the defendant on notice and then to move into the discovery stage of the process. In addition, Rule 12 of the Civil Procedure Rules goes on to authorize the dismissal of the complaint for what's called failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. So on the one hand, you have Rule 8 calling for simply a short and plain statement of the claim, and you have Rule 12 saying that you can dismiss a complaint for failure to state a claim. Well, in a series of decisions dating from the mid-20th century, the Supreme Court had set out a pretty lenient interpretation of these federal rules, particularly of Rule 8. And the major case is from 1957, a case called Conley versus Gibson. Now, Conley was not an antitrust case, but rather it was a case involving allegations of discrimination against African-American workers by unions in the railroad industry. In Conley, Justice Hugo Black wrote for the court and set out a very lenient standard for allowing a case to go forward at the pleading stage. Justice Black wrote for the court and said, quote, "In appraising the sufficiency of the complaint, we follow, of course, the accepted rule that a complaint should not be dismissed for failure to state a claim unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim which would entitle him to relief." That's pretty strong language. You cannot dismiss a complaint under Conley versus Gibson unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts ultimately that would support his claim. And applying this language from the Conley case, the Federal Court of Appeals in New York in the Twombly litigation concluded that the antitrust complaint against the telecom industry could not properly be dismissed, that the suit had to be allowed to go forward. At the pleading stage, before there was any discovery in Twombly, it simply couldn't be said, according to the Court of Appeals, that the plaintiffs ultimately would be unable to prove any set of facts showing a conspiracy to suppress competition. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court in Twombly takes a major step, I think. The Supreme Court says the Court of Appeals should not have let this lawsuit go forward to discovery. The lawsuit should have been dismissed on the pleadings. The Supreme Court says it's not enough simply to point out in the complaint that the telecommunications defendants acted in similar ways or that their similar behavior inhibited competition. It's not enough simply to say that and then tack on an assertion that the defendant companies undertook this conduct based on a conspiracy. The Supreme Court said there have to be plausible grounds to infer an agreement. And again, simply having parallel conduct is not such a plausible ground where there are plenty of sound business reasons for each defendant firm to resist competition, wholly apart from any agreement. Sound business reasons for the defendant companies to do so simply on their own without agreeing with one another. Now, Twombly is not a closely divided vote. The majority includes not only the so-called conservative justices, but also Justice Souter, who writes the opinion for the majority, and Justice Breyer. The two dissenters are Justice Stevens and Justice Ginsburg, who was a leading scholar of civil procedure prior to her appointment to the bench. Now, the big question, I think, after Twombly is how far does all of this go? And let me venture a prediction. I think that the Twombly case will unleash considerable debate, I think much-needed debate, over the real-world consequences of our modern system of civil litigation. In their dissenting opinion, Justice Stevens and Justice Ginsburg go into some length about how civil procedure in the early 20th century embraced what's called a system of notice pleading as a way to really get away from the kind of formalistic, hyper-technical approaches to pleading in the 19th century. And the basic goal was a sensible one. The goal was to avoid tripping up people with technicalities of pleading and to get fairly swiftly to the discovery stage of litigation and eventually to trial. The problem is this. This system of notice pleading led to a major and largely unanticipated development, and that is that trials in litigation have become exceedingly rare. In class actions, like Twombly, trials are darn near non-existent. So if litigation is not dismissed in the pre-trial stage, the result overwhelmingly is some sort of settlement, not a full-scale trial. So basically, dismissal on the pleadings or the possibility of summary judgment after discovery, those are the major points that remain for judicial regulation of the litigation process. Now, plaintiff's lawyers, I think, will try to confine Twombly to the unusual situation of the telecom industry today. And there's at least some plausibility to this effort to try to limit Twombly. It's true that the situation in Twombly is really the result of the aftermath of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. The 1996 Telecommunications Act broke up the monopoly positions that were previously enjoyed by the incumbent telecommunications firms. But it also went on to say a rather peculiar thing. It said not only that the incumbent firms are no longer firms that enjoy monopolies, but it also told them in various ways to actually facilitate entry, to facilitate competition in the markets in which they did business, to facilitate competition by competing firms called local exchange carriers. So it said not only you're not, to the incumbent firms, you're no longer monopolists, but you have to actually do something that businesses aren't very inclined to do, namely to facilitate competition by other companies. There are, I think, however, several indications that the Twombly decision could very well be extended more broadly, that it probably should not be regarded just as a decision simply dealing with the telecommunications industry. There are, I think, three reasons to think why the case might well be broadly extendable. First of all, the court in Twombly is ultimately deciding the case based on an interpretation of Rule 8 of the civil procedure rules. Rule 8 is not a rule confined to antitrust cases. It's not a rule confined to the telecommunications industry. It's a rule that deals with civil litigation generally. The court explicitly rejects the most expansive and lenient versions of this no set of facts language in Conley versus Gibson. That language, says the Twombly court, is best understood to describe the opportunity for the plaintiff to prove what an adequate complaint claims, not, says the court, the minimum standard of adequate pleading to govern a complaint's survival. So the court confines that broad, lenient standard in Conley and says, well, that's simply talking about what you can do once you have an adequate complaint. The language in Conley doesn't govern what makes a complaint adequate in the first place. Well, what does govern that question? The Supreme Court in Twombly repeatedly uses the word plausible. The complaint has to state enough facts, says the court, to state a claim to relief that is plausible on its face. This language of what is or is not plausible on the face of the complaint will be the source of much debate in areas outside of antitrust, outside of the telecommunications industry. The other point I would make is that there's a surprising real-world sense of the problems that have resulted from notice pleading. Getting past the pleading stage has major financial consequences for litigants. The biggest consequence is the ability for both sides to impose what can be potentially huge costs of discovery on the other side. Now, in Twombly, to be sure, the costs would have been imposed primarily by defendants on, by plaintiffs on defendants. But there's nothing inherent about the discovery process that makes the costs run uniformly against defendants or against plaintiffs. The Court of Appeals thought that these costs could be regulated by the trial judge in using the trial judge's discretion to limit the discovery process. The Supreme Court in Twombly goes out of its way to quote extensively from a 1989 Law Review article by Frank Easterbrook, now a Seventh Circuit judge, to the effect that even very capable trial judges are going to have a hard time regulating the imposition of costs through discovery. Those costs matter in the real world because they give rise to a possibility that settlement will be based not primarily on the underlying merits of the lawsuit, but will be based at least to a substantial degree by the costs simply of the litigation process itself. Those costs are not the products of conscious policy decisions in antitrust law or other areas of law, but rather they're largely the unanticipated byproducts of our system of notice pleading. And the Twombly court shows a sensible recognition that insofar as these are procedural problems, that they are probably best addressed by rethinking the system of procedure itself. The final point I'd make is that the basic circumstances of Twombly, a situation involving potentially very high discovery costs, complex allegations, a fine line between legal conduct and illegal conduct that turns on close analysis of the facts, those circumstances aren't confined to antitrust cases. There are other areas of federal litigation, especially class action litigation, that also have these features. Take securities litigation, which is already subject to heightened pleading standards by legislation specific to the securities area. Another area that I'd point to is employment discrimination litigation. Employment class actions often involve complex statistical analysis of the defendant's workforce and of the defendant's employment practices. In these respects, these other areas bear more than a passing resemblance to the circumstances in the antitrust litigation in Twombly. It may very well be that the reasoning in Twombly has some application in these other areas. The major point I'd make to close is that the major project for the current generation of civil procedure thinkers, whether they're scholars or judges or practicing lawyers, the major project will be how to design a system for civil litigation that makes sense of the world as it now exists, a world without trials, a world where the costs of the process itself can play a significant role in the settlement of litigation. Now, important thinkers are already at work in sketching out, at least in thinking about, where such a process of reform might lead in our civil justice system. I think that Twombly is a welcome step along that process.